Welcome back to another episode of In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. You know, I own two restaurants here in Brooklyn, Fausto and Lalu. We're actually taping today at Lalu. We have a special guest, my partner here, Dave Foss. Dave has an extraordinary amount of experience in the hospitality industry. He's been a wine buyer for years. We actually first started working together at my old wine bar, Anfora, where we worked together for 5 years. I was just so impressed, not only by his knowledge, his curiosity, but just the really welcoming way he interacted with all of our guests, whether they were the geekiest of wine industry professionals or a novice who just wanted to try something new. I always loved Dave's attitude when it came to hospitality, and really happy to call him my partner here at Lalu. So today we're going to get into a great interview with Dave. Welcome to In the Drink. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get started working in hospitality?
Oh, man. I started working in hospitality when I was 13 years old. I still wasn't legally able to do so, but when I went to get my card filled out for my work permit at my junior high, my sister's friend stamped me, and it was at a San Marinian. So San Marino is a country within Italy. It was a San Marinian banquet hall with a members like restaurant or club downstairs. No one was allowed to go down to the members area, but it was definitely a members area downstairs.
What do you think happened down there? Were you allowed to go down there?
No, nobody went down there. Nobody went down there except for San Marinians and some of the kids who were Italian who worked with us. But I mean, it was like a, I don't want to say it was like that kind of mobbed up kind of place, but you get the feeling that it was, even though they didn't run their business like that. But I started as a dishwasher. I worked there all the way through high school and then in college. It was great. I mean, it would never happen today because it was probably illegal and broke so many labor laws. I mean, I was a 15-year-old kid at times working on the weekend until like 2 a.m. And we'd just be in the back. I mean, we really didn't work, but it was great. We got to do whatever we wanted. It was awesome. And I worked so I started as a dishwasher, was a busboy, ended up doing like waiting, but also worked in the kitchen. I literally did everything in that place. And you could get events of up to like 1,200 people in that place. It was pretty big.
Wow.
We would do big, big weddings. And
this is in Detroit.
Suburban Detroit, yeah.
Was there something about this experience that made you want to pursue a career in the hospitality industry, or that you've taken with you, or is this just a way to pass the time?
I think it was a way to pass the time and make a little bit of money as a kid. This was a long time ago. I mean, my first hourly wage was like $2.50 an hour. This is a long time ago. This is like the late 80s, early 90s. So I was just a little kid. But I mean, I learned a lot. I mean, you learned a lot about people and how people want to be treated. I wouldn't say that I got the hospitality bug there, but I definitely started to come into an understanding and had the skill set to, you know, work in the industry. And it helped me in other avenues of things that I wanted to do. Because when I went to college, I wasn't, I hadn't planned on, you know, being in hospitality my whole life.
And where would you say you did get that hospitality bug?
I got that in LA initially. So I moved to LA. I started working in very good places when I was young. I think that's when it happened. I just, you know, seeing people have a good time and knowing that I was part of that reason, it really just kind of resonated with me. And I just continued to move through it and move up in the hospitality industry and go to different type of places. I mean, I've worked at every single type of place you can think of. I've done, you know, high-end restaurants within stadiums. I've done nightclubs, like hot Hollywood nightclubs, hot Hollywood hotels, fine dining, steakhouses. I've kind of run the gamut on the industry. I've also, hate to say it, my first bartending job was at a TGI Fridays, home of the Jack Daniel's Grill. That was 98.
Wow.
1998. That was my first bartending job. It was great. I mean, it's cheesy. I mean, I had to wear all the flair and all the buttons and the big hats and all that crazy stuff. We had to do bar flare back when they were still doing bar flare competitions, like flipping bottles. I had a menu that was, you know, an inch thick of cocktails that you had to learn. It was a great training ground. As cheesy as the place is, it's a great training ground for hospitality because you had to know what you were selling.
Was there anywhere else notable that maybe informed your approach to hospitality? Because you have this great way of really like knowing all the facts, knowing the product inside and out, but also being super relatable to people. And is there anywhere that sort of taught you that? Is that just innate in who you are?
I think it's my personality in general. I'm pretty good at reading people and being able to tell when someone's not having a good time or if they are having a good time and knowing how to talk to people. Like, everyone doesn't want to be talked to the same way. And that's one thing that I'm pretty good at, is figuring out where people are. Like, regardless of being in a restaurant setting, it might be while out and about. It might be, you know, at drinks with friends and their friends of friends. I've always had like an ability to kind of figure out how people want to be spoken to, like speak with them in the best possible way to have an enjoyable time for both myself and them.
Okay, so how do you go from TGI Fridays and working in high-end restaurants and sports stadiums and nightclubs, which I'm sure none of these are like bastions of, you know, fine wine appreciation, to your current role now in your expertise of really being someone who knows so much about wine, who is so up to date on product? Like, where did your love and passion for wine begin?
It was my first buying position. So it was while I was doing, actually before I was doing nightclubs, I did them at the same time, but I was the beverage coordinator and wine buyer at the Mondrian Hotel in West Hollywood. And we had a massive cellar. I mean, I used to get allocations of Rios, Chateau Neuf du Pape. I'd get 10 cases. We would get everything you wanted, you could get.
Now we get like two bottles.
Now you get, yeah. You get a bottle if you beg for it. But so I was I must have been like 26 or 27 when I took that job and was kind of thrown into it. And I was just completely thrown to it. And that's where the wine knowledge came, because I was trial by fire, because I had this cellar that all of a sudden I was in charge of. And I've got, you know, Dujac, I've got Reyes, I've got, you know, five vintages of Chave. We had all this crazy stuff that I had to learn about on the fly because people were buying it.
And that stuff was already there from the previous?
That stuff was already there. And then I continued
to buy
it.
Someone knew what they were doing. Yeah.
They knew what they were doing. The buyer before me was a guy named Franklin Ferguson, and he taught me a lot. He was the one who got me my first wine class, which wasn't through the court. It was through ISG, the International Sommeliers Guild, which I don't even know if it's around anymore. But he got me my first class there and kind of groomed me to take over the program. And I learned so much about wine there. And I even took that to all the places that I went to. Even if it was a nightclub, I still made sure we had good wine. And we had some grower champagne. It was so bizarre, but it was so fun to be at a nightclub, you know, serving Leonardo DiCaprio and all these other guys and going, no, you don't want Dom, you don't want Ace, you want, you know, Rosé de Gine, you want Cedric Bouchard, you want, you know, you don't want these big houses, you want these grower producers. It totally didn't fit, but it was fun.
And then did you go straight from the Mondrian to moving to New York, or...
So I was, when I left, I was at the Mondrian and I was the beverage director for a nightlife group, and I was consulting as well at that time. And I just needed to get away from LA. I needed to step away from it.
Why is that?
It's just, I was burned out. Nightlife is a very interesting and difficult business to be in, especially in Los Angeles. You deal with a lot of personalities. You deal with a lot of entitlement, and you still deal with it in New York, but it was a different type of entitlement. It's that entitlement of it's going to sound terrible, but you should pay attention to me because I'm famous. And it could be like somebody who did, you know, a half a season on The Bachelor, and all of a sudden they think they're entitled to all this stuff. But there was a sense of entitlement because of fame in Los Angeles. There's a different type of sense of entitlement in New York that I've found. And that's, I make $1 billion or I make however much money, you need to pay attention to me. It's still there. It's just different. And I just got burnt out. And, you know, dealing with staff in LA is much different than it is dealing with staff here. They both have their challenges, but I think I wanted to get out. I was like, I'm going to go away. A friend was working at a hotel in the Upper West, and he's like, hey, do you want to come consult? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll come down. Went and consulted for a couple months, and then was there for a few months on that job, and at the same time was bored, and I think that's when I applied for Amphora.
Oh.
And I also took a job as the beverage director at, or the head, whatever. I was their beverage guy at the Soho and Tribeca Grand Hotels. So I was doing that. I finished the consulting job, was working at Amphora, and Amphora really changed a lot. I mean, I was exposed to wines that I hadn't been exposed to before.
Because we were working together, so it's so important.
Because we were working together. Yeah. I learned a lot from you. I mean, you were pouring stuff that I had never had before. I had been exposed to Georgian wine, but I had not been exposed to like Grosvenor, Votopivec, Raticon. I hadn't had those wines before. Those were new. It was a new world for me.
This episode of In the Drink is sponsored by VS. For over 36 years, VS has been a leading importer and distributor of some of Italy's finest wines. Their philosophy is quality, history, and transparency, and they think that wine should always have a story to tell and should always represent its terroir to the fullest. You know, I've been working with VS at my restaurants for over 10 years, but I just found out what the acronym VIAS actually stands for, and I think it's pretty cool. It means Vitigni Italiani Autoctoni Selezionati, or Selected Italian Indigenous Grapes. So that means that the wines in their portfolio are wines made from native Italian grapes, and they're wines that clearly exhibit their terroir, local culture, and deep history. VS has over 76 unique brands imported to the U.S., including some of my favorites like the Produttore del Barbaresco, Berici, Salvioni, Castello di Rampola, and many others. So keep an eye out for that VS label on the back of a bottle of wine, because it's the mark that something uniquely delicious is inside. I'd love to hear, because I have my sense as to what we were doing there, but I'd love to hear what you think, in your words, what kind of wines we were pouring and what we were doing it in for in those days. And that was, what was that, was like 2011?
Yeah,
through
2011. 16,
17?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we were definitely, in my opinion, before our time. I mean, we were pouring orange wine before, like now, I can't keep orange wine in stock. I mean, we fly through it. It's desperate, you know, trying to find new orange wines and trying to keep them in stock. But back then,
I like to tell people the story, like when we were first opening and we had a meeting on a Thursday, and you're like, Joe, I need to call this meeting short because I got to get my orange wine order in for the weekend, because otherwise people can go crazy if we don't have it.
It would have been riots in the streets. People would have been walking out. But back then, people knew about it. People were intrigued about it. But there wasn't a lot of it. There wasn't a lot of good orange wine. And we were trying to pour the good orange wines. And it was definitely challenging. I mean, we poured Grosvenor by the glass at $20 a glass. It was hard. It was very hard to sell those wines. And now I put a $20 orange wine by the glass and it's gone in a week. But we were also, it wasn't just the orange wine. It was these off the beaten path varietals that people hadn't heard of. It was these regions that people hadn't fully accepted made good wine. I mean, you're talking about Georgia, but pre, you know, Alice Firing's book, you know, before that book came out, this was what, 2011. I mean, they'd only really been in the market for a couple of years. I mean, since the war is when you started to see, and that was 2006. So they'd only really been in the U.S. market a very short period of time, specifically these orange wines and these Quebriant wines. So we were pouring things that nobody else was really pouring.
I still remember the day, you know, because we used to taste together every Thursday, I think, from like 12.
It was every Thursday. Bishop David?
When Bishop David came in, you know, we had been excited about these orange wines and these Georgian wines that were made in Quevri, the very traditional way, right? Because Georgian wines had been imported in limited amounts for like expat communities, but those weren't the ones that we're excited about today, right?
Those were geared towards the Georgian and the Russian communities, and the Georgian and Russian market is very much sweet red.
Yeah.
That's what they drank. They drank sweet industrial red wine, or semi-sweet. They call it semi-sweet. Sorry. Semi-sweet red wine. Separavi, but it wasn't the norm of what was imported.
But we were excited about these like super traditional styles, right? The indigenous grapes aged in these buried amphora pots called Quevri. And we had been working them a little bit. And one day, this guy just dressed in like head to toe black with a long beard and a big black hat.
Yeah, his beard was down to his belly button and his hat was at least a foot or two high. It was huge. He looked like they took him out of the 1800s and they just plopped him down into, you know, the current day.
Yeah. But this guy has ended up being just such an important figure, right, in the Georgian wine movement. He was helping to restore the use of Quevri and push forward, right? Wasn't he like an architect?
He was an architect, mm-hmm. I believe he was an architect. But he was the catalyst. He was really the catalyst for a lot of these young winemakers, him and John Woodman, who was the other guy who's from Virginia, I think, or San Francisco. He's a character. And that's part of this industry. It's about the wine, but people also want to know a little bit about who's making it. What type of people are there? I mean, there's just too much good wine to buy from someone who's a, can I say, asshole?
We're lucky in New York to have access to so much amazing wine.
We are. We have access to wines that most markets, sometimes even Los Angeles, doesn't get. Because I go all over the country for a lot of these consulting jobs, I see what are in some of these small markets. And it's tough. You go to like Idaho or Utah, like the availability of wine, of cool wine that is organic, biodynamic, or from places like Georgia's is very, very limited. So we're blessed in New York to really get the first crack at so many of these cool wines.
What else was notable about your experience at Anfora? Do you have any other fond memories or not such fond memories?
I mean, I have a lot of fond memories. I mean, the West Village was the best village, you know? I loved that neighborhood. I loved just the wines we poured, the Midnight Magnums we used to do. I think they still do it, but I love that. I mean, it's just fun, just popping really fun, cool bottles, and people would just come in and they would allow me to like curate, you know, their experience, which is fun.
When we were there, there was a nice industry, like restaurant industry crowd that was coming late at night.
Massive. Everybody, like all the wine nerds, all the like the cool wine folk that worked in the neighborhood, you know, at all the great restaurants that were around there. I mean, there's still so many great places, but you had Cork Buzz or, you know, Del Posto, our family down at L'Artusi, Beatrice Inn. It was great neighbors coming in, great wine people coming in all the time to drink cool stuff.
And you really ran that place, you know, we worked pretty closely together, but you were the wine buyer for years and ran that place. And I got to see just how, you know, how great you are with your team and also just with guests. I was always impressed at Anfora how you could always, you know, you could talk to any table and figure out what wine they wanted to drink. That was always something I was so impressed by you. Like you could get any table the wine that they wanted to drink. You speak guest speak.
I try to speak guest speak. It's about listening and really, really understanding what it is they want. You know, some people will say, I want something, you know, really heavy and big. And then they say, oh, what do you normally drink? Well, I like Russian River Pinot. It's like, okay, I know where you're at. That you don't want this, you want this. So it's understanding. You have to really understand, especially when you're dealing in the type of wines that we deal with, the off the beaten path, the varietals that people don't know. You have to understand your benchmarks and your classic to be able to sell the weird stuff, because people need a frame of reference, if that makes sense. Like they need a frame of reference for a particular wine that they don't know, that might daunt them. You know, people look at, you know, our list here and you see things like Orangetraub. Nobody, unless they know it, nobody's ordering it. Like, you have to sell it. And that's a grape and a wine, a specific wine that people come in and they're like, oh, I like Sauvignon Blanc. I like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, or I like Sancerre. I'm like, oh, yeah, I gotcha. Let me give you a taste. You pour them and they're like, oh, this is great. What is this? I'm like, well, this is a Orangetraub from Austria. Yada, 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 yada. I go in the whole spiel on it. But I don't want to say you trick them into it, because you're not tricking them into it. You're giving them the flavor profile they want, but you have to understand what that profile is, if that makes any sense at all.
Do you think it is? It does make sense. I wonder, do you think it's easier for you to sell wine or to speak about wine with someone who's in the industry, or the, like, a novice who wants to just drink something delicious?
I think it's, I can speak the speak if I need to.
I've seen it. We have the geekiest wine professionals coming in. And, you know, a lot of them live close to Lalu, and you could speak that speak. And I'm also, like, impressed how you could, you know, someone really doesn't know anything about wine, you can make them feel excited. But which is like easier for you?
I mean, it's easier to sell people who don't speak the speak, because they don't, you know, the moment you start using the words that people that speak the speak, they get really, like, turned off. So you just have to speak very simply and clearly with terms that make sense to them. It's not always saying, oh, there's, you know, bright cherry and a hint of pomegranate. It's not always given the flavor profile of it. Sometimes it's, what's the difference between this wine and this wine? This one's light and dainty. This one's feisty. It's bigger. It kicks you in the face. You know, it's got a little more oomph to it. And that alone will sell the wine to them. But you have to make sure that you're talking to that person. That's what they want to hear. If you're talking to a wine person, they don't want to hear that. They want to hear about the bright cherry and the soft, you know, undertones of pepper.
In that voice. You have to do it in that voice.
In that voice. That's important. Yeah, I got all the tables like, there's some sandalwood on the palate. But it's understanding, that goes back to, you know, reading the guests and understanding what how people want to be talked to, especially about wine. People get daunted. People get daunted when people start throwing around words that they don't understand. And sometimes they'll ask about things, and making a parallel will always help. It's like, you know, why is this wine orange? What is orange wine? And you just have to, you can't be like, well, it's macerated on the skins for up to yada yada. You got to be like, it's a white wine made like a red wine. What do you mean? Well, the juice of most grapes is of red and white grapes, or at least that we make wine out of, is going to be clear. What gives red wine its color most of the time is contact with the skins. So you let it sit, gets a little color, voila, you have red wine. Most white wine, they just press, it goes through, there's no contact, it stays clear. But with orange wine, they let it sit on the skins for a little bit. So it gets a little bit, sometimes it can get an orangey color, which is why people call it orange wine.
It sounds like the technique here is to just speak plain English and not use any jargon.
No, don't.
Yeah.
Like if you say macerated, people are going to look at you like you're a douchebag, unless they're in the industry. Unless they're in the industry. I went to a place once. And this was in LA, and I asked for if they had any orange wine. And this guy doesn't know me. He doesn't know I'm in the industry. He doesn't know any of that. And he's like, oh, do you mean skin macerated white? And I'm like, yeah, I do. But the whole time I'm thinking, really? You're going to say that to a guest? Like, I'm in the industry. I know, I understand, but you don't know that. Like, you don't need to correct some guy who's on a date. Like, it's bad business. Sorry.
Switching gears a little bit. What are the kinds of wines that you most like to drink?
I mean, I like, I like acid. I like Austrian wine, but I tend to lean towards wines that have a decent amount of acid to them. I tend to drink whites leaner, lighter reds, but I'm also a mood drinker. Sometimes I want to get weird. Sometimes I want to, if I've had like a rough day, I want like a bigger, broader red wine. I might go for like something Barolo. I might even go for a Brunello. God forbid, I might even have a Bordeaux if I'm having a bad day. Sometimes you just want something.
It's funny, when I have a bad day, I'm like the opposite. If it's like a bad day, I want something just like chuggable, like that I could maybe drink a lot of, that's low alcohol and refreshing.
Well, if I'm having a, like, I want to drink it by candlelight and brewed.
And when you're putting together a wine list, how much do you take into account your own personal taste versus what you think guests are going to be looking for?
There has to be balance. I've had this conversation a million times. There's a lot of wines that I buy that I even bought here that I don't like. Like, I don't want to drink them. They're not for me. But I taste them, and I don't know how many times I've said this to wine reps when they come in. They're like, what do you think? And I'm like, I hate it. They're like, oh, well. I'm like, but it's a well-made wine. They're like, oh, okay. And I'm like, I'll take 5 cases. Really? And you kind of say, yeah, because I know exactly who buys this wine. And they are going to love it. They're going to eat it up. Just because it's not my palate and what I like doesn't mean that it's not a good wine. And yeah, I mean, there's still the majority of the wines I really love and enjoy that we buy. But sometimes you really have to think about who's coming into your space. What do they drink? What do they want to drink? Where does it fit on your list? Because there's factors like, do I drink a ton of, I mean, I just said I occasionally will drink Bordeaux, but I don't normally, like, only when I'm having a really bad day do I drink Bordeaux. So it's not my personal thing, but Bordeaux sells. People love it. And there are biodynamic producers that make wonderful, beautiful wines. And they're also a little more expensive, which is great when you're looking at, a wine list. Some people want to come in and they want to spend money. And if they see a wine that's $60, they might not buy it. But if they see a wine that's $120, they may go, that's the wine I want.
Yeah, for me in the past, that had always been Amarone. That's not the wine that I like to drink a lot. And it's still a pain to me to put that on the list, but there are people who are just so happy to be drinking the Amarone, and I'd have that one bottle, but you wouldn't want to see more than one or two bottles on the list that they wouldn't drink.
Did that burn?
Yeah, that Amarone burn. And raisins be so hot.
Oof.
This episode of In the Drink is brought to you by 750.com. 750.com is the most important resource for beverage buyers. I use 750.com on a daily basis, not just because of the vast amount of products that are listed on the site. I mean, everything I could possibly want for my restaurants, Fausto and Lalu, are located on 750, but also because of how reliable that information is. For me, when I'm ordering something, I need to know that it's going to be there and the information on it is going to be accurate and true so that I can plan out my beverage program. So it's always so helpful to me to know that when I order something on 750, it's going to be the wine or the beer or the liquor that they say it's going to be there. It's the correct vintage. It's in stock. They know that it matters and makes a huge difference for buyers just like me and like you. So go to 750.com and open up an account today. Today's episode is brought to you by Melio, a digital payables platform made just for small businesses. If you're a small business and you deal with a bunch of different vendors, as I know I do at my restaurants, sometimes it can be hard to keep track of a ton of different invoices, all with different pay-by dates and different terms. Melio is one simple platform that allows you to centralize all of your invoices and pay them on a timely manner, making sure that you're never late for a payment, or sometimes even worse, pay too early. With Melio, sending payments and even requesting them is made simple and easy and can be done all in one local place. Visit gomelio.com and add your first bill to get started. And so after all this time in Manhattan and, you know, all this vast experience that, that you have, what made you want to open up a wine bar with me in Brooklyn?
I mean, I enjoy working with you. You've got similar palates, but we also have, like, there are slight differences here and there. So it's good to have a balance when it comes to, like, wine list stuff, because it's just, you need that secondary, like, opinion to balance out a list so it's just not your sole vision. I think it creates a broader, more approachable list to have another person in it. But I mean, opening a bar, I mean, there's nothing around here. You live two blocks away. I live, you know, a 20-minute walk away or a 5-minute drive. And there was nothing here. Like, there's all these great restaurants. And yeah, some of them have some good wine, but there wasn't a place that had, like, the scope of wine in the neighborhood that I like. You know, and that's something that I just saw. I think both of us saw that void in the market. It's like there's so many, there's all this development, there's all these people coming in this neighborhood. And I just saw that void and knew that it was like, this is what we're going
to
do.
And so, what do you think that Lalu brings to the scene here? Just a bigger wine list than other places?
No, it's about the scope of natural biodynamic wine. I think there is a perception that, like, to be natural and biodynamic, that there is this lean, like, spectrum of wine, right? You have this small little, this is what natural wine is. It has to be a little bit funky. It has to be a little bit wild. And that's not the case. There's a lot of different natural wines out there that are underappreciated or forgotten about. And I wanted to make sure that we showed the full scope of what natural wine is, what it means to be organic and biodynamic, minimal intervention. What does that mean? And it's not just one specific style of wine. You can have one that's completely bizarre and weird. And you can have one that's very clean and pristine and beautiful. And that's what I think we offer. I mean, you could be the nattiest of natty folk, come in here and say, and people do. They come in and they say, I want the weirdest thing you have. And I'm like, oh, cool. I got something for you. And people also come in and say, I normally drink Burgundy. What do you have? And I could give something for them as well. So you can kind of hit the scope of things as opposed to just being very specific and narrow.
Something that I've been thinking about, you know, I noticed, you know, at Fausto as well, people are more interested in these wines that present as being a little weirder, right? And for sure, we didn't get as many guests at Amphora in 2011, right? And 12, who wanted that? So times have changed. But I wonder how much of a difference it is in Manhattan versus Brooklyn. You've worked in Manhattan more recently than I have as well. Do you think that maybe people who go out in Brooklyn or live in Brooklyn are looking for these kind of weirder styles, or is this something that's all over the place?
I think it depends where you are in Manhattan. I think if you say, I have a restaurant in Midtown East, ain't nobody buying no orange wine up there. I mean, nobody's asking for, you know, Sans Souffle, you know, whites from the Loire, for that matter. I mean, that's not the palate of that area. But I think if you're down in the Lower East Side or you're in the East Village, it's completely different. That, like, you go into those places and the majority of them are natural. I mean, you've got a lot of great wine bars down there and restaurants that are solely focused on natural wine. I mean, to be honest, I think probably one of the first natural wine bars in New York would be, what, 10 Bells in the Lower East Side?
For sure.
I mean, they were one of the pioneers in that. And, I mean, they're still going strong. So I feel like, depending on where you are in Manhattan, that kind of dictates the demand for natural wine. Whereas opposed, you go to Bushwick, Williamsburg, Prospect Heights, Cobble Hill, Red Hook, people are drinking natural wine. You won't see that scope in Manhattan. I think another good thing that we've done, and they disappear fast, but it's giving, like, a little bit of history of wine. let's face it, like organics and biodynamics has become widespread and commonplace only in the past 15 years. So you have these producers who we have, and yeah, maybe they're biodynamic now, or maybe they've been biodynamic since 2008, but don't you think it might be interesting to taste some of those wines from, you know, the 80s or the 90s? I think that's cool. I think that's fun. And some people might give me shit about it and say, well, that's not natural. I'm like, yeah, but you're seeing the history of this winery and how things have progressed and how things have changed and how styles have changed. I mean, not just, you know, the palate of people has changed. I mean, you could take a look at a wine from 85. It's going to be completely different from a wine in the mid 90s during the Parker, you know, the Parker years. And that's going to be different from when things started taming back in the mid 2000s to where we're at now. So you could see the whole scope of somebody in their history. And I personally think that's cool.
How do you do that practically, table side?
I mean, practically, I mean, you really can't. I mean, you do it with, there's only certain guests who are going to understand, not even understand, who are going to want that journey. But we get them. And even if it only happens once a month and you get somebody who's like, I see this wine here. I see this wine from, like, it might be one of the old Austrian wines. I had somebody come in. They ordered the 83, you know, Kolvenz Romerhof St. Laurent. And then they ordered a different St. Laurent from the mid-2000s. And it was, they're like, wow, it's interesting to see the style, how they change and how different this is from where we're at, you know, over the course of time.
I know you're like particularly really great at finding these wines with age. And, you know, anyone can find, you know, can spend $2,000 and get a Barolo of Monfortino from, you know, 1999 or whatever. But like you're able to find these wines that maybe aren't so obvious that they would have like had some age, and you're able to put things on the list like a Saint Laurent or, you know, a bottle from Tissot that has, you know, 10, 15 years of age on something like that. How are you able to find some of these wines without giving away too many of the secrets so that we can continue to them here at La Lalu?
You really have to hunt. You really have to, I mean, you hit up auctions, but I think the key with that is not looking for the blue chips. Everybody's got the blue chips. You could find the blue chips anywhere. I can go and I can get expensive old Bordeaux any given day. I'm going to spend out my ass for it, but I can go get it. Whereas it's much more difficult to find some of these wines that have, you know, it's hard to find old St. Laurent or Buff Frankish or, you know, even some off the beaten path, you know, Northern Rhone producers. It's hard to find them, but if you know them and you see it at the auction block, you see it, you know, for sale somewhere, you go, oh, wow, that's, but it's hunting, it's digging. I'm on a line all the time when I can't sleep at night, when my little girl is crying in my ear, I'm like online trying to get her to go to sleep. You know, I'm hunting, I'm looking for stuff, seeing what's out there.
Now, you mentioned Austrian wine a few times, and you know, you've been to Austria more times than anyone I know who isn't Austrian. What drove you to that country and the wines from there? What got you initially interested about them, and what keeps bringing you back?
I mean, there. I think initially it was a sense of nostalgia. I played soccer when I was a kid for a pretty good team, and when I was 15, we were invited to go on a trip to Europe, and we played all over Europe. We played Germany, Italy, Austria. We even made a little foray into Slovenia. This is 92, so I don't know that it was fully above board, but the first place that we played in was, we flew into Frankfurt and we drove immediately down to a little town just outside of Innsbruck called Wier. And we played a game there, the only flat ground in the entire town was the soccer field. Like everything was like on the hills. It was beautiful. It wasn't a winemaking town. It was like, I think it was a dairy town. But so you played this game, and then afterward, and we had a lot of these meals, you sat down with everybody. You sat down with the other team. We would eat dinner, and we'd drink wine, even though we were 15. Well, I was 15. I was one of the younger kids, but you know, everybody ate and drank together. And that whole trip was eating and drinking wine. after games and just breaking bread with your host families and all that kind of thing. And but Austria being the first one and that I did it in. And that, you know, as I became a buyer in the 2000s, you know, Austrian wine was just starting to come back and you were starting to see it a little bit more. And I just kind of fell in love with it. And part of it was, you know, remembering this beautiful idyllic, you know, scenery when we were playing back in the day. And now I go all the time. I'll go to Vivenum this year and I'll also go there and I'll see if we can find some cool old Austrian wines. But I just love, I love the country. It's beautiful. I love Vienna. Such a great town. Such a town of culture. And the wines there are diverse and they last a long time. I don't think they get, I think in the wine circles, they get a lot of credit, but I think outside of the wine circles, they don't get the credit they deserve. I think they deserve a place at the table. Some of these old Gruners, some of these old Blaufränkisches, they deserve a place with the greats.
What most excites you about the Austrian wine scene right now?
I think there's some cool stuff happening in the natural wine scene there. I think it's like a hotbed. Initially, it was kind of focused in Styria and Burgenland, but it's starting to make its way up to, you know, you're seeing more and more people in, you know, Niederösterreich really start to do, you know, more natural wines. So Niederösterreich's like north of Vienna, like got Wachau, Kamptal, Kremstal, Wagram. You're seeing more and more people do interesting stuff up there. But you know, there's just cool things happening. There's great producers, a lot of young people, a lot of really young winemakers just making cool wines using all their native grapes like Blaufränkisch, St. Laurent, Neuburger, Rotburger. We don't call it Zweigelt. And then Gruner and Riesling. I mean, they just do great. And even Welsh Riesling. I think Welsh Riesling is, it has been the grape for me that I'm seeing that I've really kind of fallen in love with. And I can't say why. I just know that I've had a lot of wonderful Welsh Rieslings lately.
Why don't we call it Zweigelt?
Dr. Zweigelt wasn't a great guy. I mean, we could get into more specifics.
Enough said.
It's pretty political. It's pretty political. The grape was originally, when it was created by Dr. Zweigelt in the 20s, was originally called Rotburger. And then I think it was either in the late 60s or the 70s that they changed the name to Zweigelt. But apparently he wasn't such a delightful person and had some affiliations during the war.
Some unsavory affiliations.
Yes, some unsavory affiliations.
I also feel like you have a deep knowledge of the wines from Eastern Europe. I know you've been to Georgia, which I guess is Eurasia. I don't know if that's considered Eastern Europe. But where did your interest in those wines begin and what draws you to them?
I think the first time I had Georgian wine was I was still living in Los Angeles. So it must have been like 2009, 2010. And it was Pheasant's Tears. That was the first one.
Cool.
That was really the only Georgian wine at the time.
And then we poured that together at Anfora.
Yeah.
2 years later.
Yep. I remember there was a wine shop close to where I live called Silver Lake Wine, and I used to go to their tastings every month. And they were at the cutting edge in Los Angeles of natural wine and just wine in general. And they would do these tastings every, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday. And I remember they would pour, like for these events, sometimes they'd pour just Georgian wine or just Hungarian wine. And that's when I really started to become like, oh, these are cool wines. And they're not that expensive. These guys have a sense of place. And these are really cool. I really enjoy those. And I think that's kind of where it started. And there wasn't a lot then. I mean, the scope was very, very limited. I mean, you had Pheasant's Tears, you had some, you know, Hungarian producers, some Croatian producers like Bibic back then, but there wasn't many. It's only been in the past, you know, 8 years that you really started to see some of those wines. In the Czech, it's only been in the past 5 years that you've really seen some cool stuff come out of the Czech Republic. That makes it to the U.S. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure, some of it was there before, but it's only been fairly recently that these things have kind of come to our, you know, conscious.
Do you feel like you're sort of always looking for them, looking for cool things coming out? Because I know we have a decent amount of Hungarian wine here. We have some Czech wine, some Slovenian wine here at Lalu. So are you kind of always looking for these or to?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm always looking for anything that's interesting and good. It's crazy because there are some cult wines, some cult natural wines from Eastern Europe that we don't carry here. And it's not because they're not good, but it's because they've become so popular that I can't sell them because they're everywhere. Like, even though they're allocated, they become so much of a thing that they're harder to sell because all the places have them. And so I've got to find other little avenues.
So you say our guests here are looking for discoveries sometimes.
People are looking for discoveries. They're definitely looking for discoveries. People always ask me, is there anything new? Is there anybody, you know, out of Austria that you're really excited about? And you know, like, yeah, there's some people that I really feel they haven't hit the Instagram market yet. So people don't know about them as much. Wirlitch is one of them. I love Wirlitch. I love those wines, but they haven't really, they're not as much in the hip, cool kid camp yet.
And they're out of Austria?
Mm-hmm. He's out of Steiermark. Down in Styria.
I know we mentioned Georgia a few times, but you're one of the few people I know, other than myself, who's been there. Tell me about your trip. What did you find surprising?
I mean, it was interesting because I was surprised by the amount of industrial producers that there are.
Yeah.
I was surprised by that, but I was even more surprised by the amount of people making such small amounts of wine in what would amount to their basement or their backyard shed. The amount of cool things happening there is just, it's great. But it's a different place. The place itself is different. I remember still seeing people toast to a statue of Stalin. And I'm like, wow. And they're sitting outside and and I asked one of the winemakers, I'm like, what is going on? They're like, old timers. They think he was a fine guy. And I'm like, wow, okay. I mean, but I was really surprised by, you know, the breadth of what's happening there and how all these people have gone to extreme lengths to start cultivating some of these grape varieties that just got ripped out during communism. And, you know, so-and-so winemaker had a couple of cuttings of this grape and now we're turning it into something new. Not new, but we're turning it into like the new thing and trying to revive like an ancient wine culture that was, for all intents and purposes, gutted during communism, with the exception to people making wine in their backyards or in their back farmhouse. It's interesting to see. It's been great to see. Thank God they continued that tradition, because otherwise we wouldn't have it anymore.
I feel like you are just this encyclopedia of wine knowledge. It's so rare. You know, a lot of times I'll find a wine and I'll send it over to you and be like, oh, Dave, do you know about this one? And you're almost always like, yep, I know that wine. It's great. I like this vintage better. Like, how do you stay up to date on all of your wine info?
I mean, I read a lot. I'm constantly looking around. I look at people's wine lists. I like to know what people are doing. When I go into a restaurant and I see something I don't know, I'm like, what is that? Who is that? Who's the importer? I dig a lot. I try and dig and find, and I'll go out and I'll buy it myself. If an importer has it to taste, I'll be like, hey, can you bring this by to taste? I'd love to taste it. But it's just constant research. It's constantly trying to figure out what's going on, who's producing what. I think a key is going outside of some of the usual suspects when it comes to your purchasing and trying wines from importers who might not have an entirely natural book. For me, it's been very valuable because some of these books have hidden gems. You might look at their portfolio and say, not everything in here is biodynamic or even organic for that matter. But every now and then you'll go through some of these. And sometimes it's a bigger book and sometimes it's a smaller book. But you go through and you'll be like, I want to try that. And that's where you find the gems for me. And so you find these things that people haven't heard of And then at some point they end up moving distributors to like one of the cool kid distributors, and then it's over. But that's why a lot of times I'll know them beforehand, is because I'm cool. Hunting.
You're doing a lot of tasting with your distributors.
I do.
What are you reading?
I just get online. If I see something, I just get online. You kind of look for, like, I'll ask friends. And so sometimes I'll be like, hey, you know, when Roland was here, I'm like, hey, do you know this guy,
Mike Roland Muff? Velik from Moritz?
Roland Velik. I was like, hey, do you know this guy, Mike Muff? He's in Burgenland. Never had his wines, but I've heard about him. And he's like, oh, yeah. He goes, I don't know if he's still making wine. He made wine for like 5 years. He's just a Swiss guy. And, you know, So I learned from other winemakers as well. Like, who's doing cool stuff? Who isn't imported yet, but they're like on the cusp of being the next like it winemaker in that particular area? You have to ask people, because they always want to tell you their protégés or the people that they're really excited about.
Okay, one last question to finish off on. It's a two-part question. What was the first great bottle of wine you ever had? And then what was the last great bottle of wine you've had?
First bottle, 98 Reyes. Beautiful.
Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
I mean,
an icon.
My palate has changed a lot since then. I don't drink those. I mean, Reyes is definitely a lean down comparatively to some, but I mean, at that point in my life, that's what people were drinking. And that was the first really great bottle of wine that I had. It was just beautiful. And I think that was one of my aha wines when I was young, when I was first getting into the industry.
Did you have that in LA at the Mondrian?
I did.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy place, man. That was a crazy place.
And do you remember the last great bottle of wine you had?
The one that really had a lot of, that had a big impact, it was a bit ago. It was like probably like a year ago. It was in Amsterdam, and it was the Domaine de Miroir wine from Kinjiro Kagami. I had been wanting to try the wine, like couldn't find it anywhere. You can't get it anywhere. Saw that they had a post of it on Instagram. We were in Amsterdam, went in there, and I said, I want Domaine de Miroir. He goes, how do you know this wine? Wasn't even on the list. How do you know this wine? I'm like, well, you know, I heard about it, blah, blah, blah. He goes, well, what do you normally drink? What producers do you like in the Jura? The guy grilled me for 15 minutes. 15 minutes of questions. What producers do I like from different areas? Have I had this wine? He asked me about some wines on his list. And after like 15 minutes, he goes, okay, you're worthy to have this wine. I was like, wow. He poured me the wine. He also apologized. He just said, look, I get 3 bottles of this wine a year. I have to be very specific with who I give it to. And we opened it up, and it was super reduced initially. But after like 45 minutes, it just blossomed into this beautiful, like pristine, razor sharp, just uber focused wine.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you as a guest.
Thank you for having me. It's been a blast. It's been fun sitting in our little wine bar, restaurant.
At table 21.
Wine restaurant. At table 21.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of In the Drink. I want to give a huge thank you to our producer, Jessamyn Molly of Seaplane Armada. And a big thanks to Justin D. Wright for the ad music. And thank you so much to Renny Lopez for the theme music. It would be a huge help if you give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. And if you have any questions or suggestions, feel free to shoot us an email at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next week.